Jam on Sunday nights from 9 to 11 p.m. or Saturday mornings from 1 to 3 a.m. and streaming live anytime at krvs.org.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, the best cultural show on radio as well, coming to you from the swamplands of South Louisiana. It is so nice to have all of you in our little Cajun cabin today as we pour us a cup of coffee. I'm going to begin by welcoming Michelle Yark, our executive producer. How are you doing there, Miss Yark?
I'm good. I have a little tickle in my throat. Would you mind passing a cup of coffee down?
Oh, not at all. Anyway, across the glass wall with Michelle is, of course, our fantastic engineer and our co-host
of the show,
Dean Slam. How you doing, Dean?
Hey, y'all.
How do you feel about being in February? You know Valentine's Day is right around the corner.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you imagine? Huh?
It's hard to imagine. It really is.
Are you ready for that?
I'm not ready for that. I'm still dealing with New Year's, you know.
Still trying to get over New Year's. We're sitting in
I'm
here.
I'm still writing 2012 and all my checks.
So, well, yeah, I mean, I do that. I go to about March with 2012, I swap over. You know, anyway, y'all, thank you so much for being here. Dean, thank you so much for being here. Well, you know, tomorrow's a big day. You know that, huh?
Super Bowl 47 in New Orleans.
That's right. The only thing better than having a big game in our backyard would be if our Saints would be. End it again, you know what I mean, huh?
Well, it was a tough year, but maybe next year.
Yeah, maybe next. Yeah, how many times do we hear maybe next year, huh?
That's what the loser's saying.
Hey, here's a trivia question for you over there, Slama.
What you got?
Do you know how many times a Super Bowl game has been played in its own stadium of the winners of the game? Do you know how many times?
Goodness, it's got to be a rare coincidence. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Okay, we're playing stats now.
Yeah,
I got to do a little research. Can we come back to that question?
I'll give you till the break to come up with the answer.
Okay.
When we take our first break, I mean, when you finish drinking your first cup of coffee. In the meantime, you know that this is the 10th year that New Orleans has hosted the Super Bowl. The most times any city has hosted the bowl game, except for Miami, which, of course, you know, we're tied with them on the number.
Oh,
10.
Yeah.
So with this game, we're tied with them.
Well, yeah, and Miami did put in a bid for the 2013 game, but
we won.
Lost to us. We're not on the field, but they lost to us. And this will be our first Super Bowl, though, since Katrina.
Wow, that could be emotional. And you know that will certainly be part of the commentary for all the sportscasters. You know, 2011, there was a lot of renovation of the dome, so certainly that's going to be...
It's going to be a big part of the broadcast. They're going to be talking about that because the dome is beautiful. And the work that's going on in New Orleans for this big game is just incredible. Street renovations, lights.
It's a mess.
You're right about that.
Well, look, it's a better mess than it was. Mayor Landrieu and the team down there has done such an unbelievable job to get that city ready and that whole Super Bowl commission down there. You know, it was Jim Carville and Mary Madeline. I mean, they're the ones who's kind of rallied to get all that stuff done. You know,
They've done a great job.
Yeah, we got a big team down there.
I have some trivia.
Okay.
Before there was a Superdome, there were 3 Super Bowl games played in New Orleans. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
And you know where they played them?
Well, they had to play them in the old Tulane Stadium, right?
Tulane Stadium. The first Super Bowl game to be played in the Dome wasn't until 1978. Selma probably wasn't born yet.
Well, and that was in commemoration of the opening of Lafitte's Landing. Yeah, by Lafitte's Landing restaurant opened that year. They said, well, look, they got a great restaurant over there. Let's put the bowl
game. That must have been it. That must have just kind of like sealed the deal.
Well, y'all, the new Dome, we're talking about the newly renovated Dome, is something else. Over 77,000 seats.
Okay. What was that number again?
77,000.
Well, I like that, but I mean, think about Tiger Stadium on a Saturday night.
Well, I mean, LSU Stadium, you got 100,000 sitting over there.
That's kind of crazy to think about, isn't it?
But
that's 90,000 people having to bring umbrellas. You see, at the dome, it's 70 degrees all day long. Now, that's what makes the Super Bowl so exciting about being in New Orleans. They guaranteed no snow.
And the field won't be wet.
And the field will not be wet. And the private boxes and suites are so elaborate, y'all, you cannot even believe it. As luxurious as they are, and with all the excitement of being there, I have to tell you, though, I much prefer to watch that big game right in front of my TV.
Now, come on.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't have tickets.
I was off at 50-yard line seats.
Right. Slum.
No, I'm serious. Look, I like the excitement of the game. I'd rather watch it at home, you know.
I've got a nice television. It's almost, you know, a better experience.
Yeah.
But you know what? I don't even think it's about the TV. No. I think it's about the stove.
Absolutely about it. And pork is somewhere on it.
I have no doubt there's going to be pork. And John's kitchen is set up so that he can cook and watch the game at the same
that's
time.
That's right. I have what's referred to as kitchen stadium. You know, I have the real kitchen stadium. You know, if I get slime, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a picture of the kitchen so people can see what kitchen stadium looks like.
I would like to see that.
And you know the best news of all?
What?
I don't have a whole rowdy crowd coming.
Oh, baloney. I don't believe that.
No, I don't believe that.
Well, Chef Louie's going to be there, and he's going to be causing all kinds of mischief.
Well, Louie's going to be there because I am making Spanish pork roast sandwiches.
Ooh. That sounds pretty good, actually.
Yeah, no matter which team takes the Super Bowl trophy, I'm going to tell you what, my Super Bowl sliders, you're going to be the winner. And speaking of trophies, here's another little trivia question for you. Who is the Super Bowl trophy named after Miss Yark?
Okay. I know this because we actually saw that trophy, the Saints trophy.
Yeah, we did. Absolutely.
Give me a second. But I do know some stuff about it.
Yeah, just because we talked about it during the break, we didn't tell you.
We didn't even have a break yet. That trophy was designed on a cocktail napkin in 1967.
Right.
Now, I'm happy to say, Slama, that even I wasn't born yet.
I'm happy to say I was on the work day. I was working that day.
Well, it was designed over lunch between the NFL commissioner.
Old Pete, yeah.
That's right. And the Pete president of Tiffany and Company, Oscar Reidner. Since that day, the trophy, the Vince Lombardi trophy. Did I get it?
You got it. Vince Lombardi.
The Vince Lombardi trophy has been made by Tiffany and Company in Parsippany, New Jersey. One gorgeous chunk of silver is all I'm going to say. That's what I call bling.
And in fact, that same Tiffany, believe it or not, came on board again to design the tableware and the platters that the United States culinary team are using in the Culinary Olympics. They created it absolutely as a gift to the team, and you ought to see what those platters look like.
Beautiful.
And, yeah, those pliers are about 48 inches long.
Tiffany blue?
Oh, they're beautiful. Absolutely
just
beautiful.
Just curious.
How about those rings? I mean, after all, you know, we have to give some credit to the players themselves. The NFL covers the cost of 150 rings for the winning team. You know how much they cost, Mama, each ring? You know what each ring sells for? 150 rings. Well, you'd think it'd be for both teams for 150. Who'd he give it those rings to? Anyway, 150 rings, the NFL covers the cost. 5,000 macaronis for each ring.
Almost $1 million for rings.
That's right.
But not just the players get the rings.
Yeah.
The rings can go to whoever they choose. I mean, it can be players, coaches, trainers, executives. Good friends of the family, maybe.
But don't you feel sorry for him? I mean, NFL, can you imagine having to put out $1 million? I mean, I wonder where he get the money from.
Yeah, I wonder.
I mean, this might put a strain on the budget.
Yeah, it's going to be tight.
It's got to be a small price to pay, huh? Well, you know, the rings are quite elaborate.
Yeah, well, we took pictures of them last year.
Yeah, I wore it. I put one on.
Put a Super
Bowl
ring.
Photos on my phone. I'll show you during the break.
Oh, it can't fit right, huh?
Oh, yeah, you could put a whole wrist in it. Yeah,
yeah, you could put a whole wrist in it. But, you know, traditionally they're either white or yellow gold and loaded with diamonds. I mean, loaded with diamonds.
Yeah, they got a lot of diamonds. Huh?
They have the team name, the logo, the Super Bowl number. Of course, a lot of the rings find their way, believe it or not, to charity auctions or raffles, sometimes even to eBay. Not so long ago, a 1970s ring sold for over $32,000.
Wow.
Can you imagine that? $32,000?
Well, all the diamonds is probably on the budget. You know?
Could have been.
Well, I don't think they had that many diamonds on the 1970
probably
rings.
Not.
They've gotten pretty elaborate since then.
In 2008, one of the Patriots players...
Gerard, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. He raffled his ring to benefit charities that worked with children in Africa.
Gerard Cherry made a lot of publicity because of that. You know, it's good. But you see, that's really what it should be all about, right?
I think so. And you know, there was another guy, Shannon Sharp of the Denver Broncos. He gave his ring to his brother because his brother's career had been cut short by an injury.
Well, I bet there's a lot of great stories like that.
I'm sure there are. And I mean, you know, that's just, that's beautiful.
Well, I have to say I'm impressed with your knowledge of Super Bowl facts, even though it did relate in a small way to diamonds and gold, which really gets our attention anyway. You know
Bling.
What I'm talking about, huh? Yeah.
Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Yes, you got diamonds for Christmas this year.
Oh, no kidding,
yeah,
Michelle.
Yeah, beautiful.
Thank you.
They were very beautiful.
Very beautiful, I know. Got them on right now.
I know you do. I saw them. I can't look that way.
You're so bad.
So, by the way, did you answer my first question or what?
None. Zero. No teams have ever played in a Super Bowl in their home stadium.
None.
Zero. This would have been the first time.
This would have been the first time the Saints.
So, when does the Super Bowl come back to New Orleans?
Well, if I were playing our cards right, I think, let me see, it's 2018, I guess it might be. Yeah, maybe 2018, I think, is the next one they're bidding on. I know New Orleans is going to bid on it. I heard talk.
You heard talk.
I heard talk, right.
Mm-hmm. What other city could be as much fun as New Orleans?
Well, that's why New Orleans...
Where was it last year? Indianapolis?
That's why New Orleans has tied with Miami for 10 each.
We even threw Mardi Gras in. Now, I realize they're suspending the parades, you know.
Yeah.
But they start up right after so people can just keep on partying.
Yeah. So New Orleans is without a doubt, in our opinion, which is of course highly valued, New Orleans is the best place for
best place
a Super
for
Bowl. Why? Number one, hospitality. Number two, which ranks right with hospitality, food.
Of course.
Number three, fun. Anyway, y'all, you know what we're talking about today? We're talking about Super Bowl.
That's why you got offered tickets.
That's why I got offered tickets. That's exactly right. I could bring my gang with me. Huh?
We in your gang.
Yeah, you're in my gang. That's what I said. They knew I
co-host
and
co-host.
Anyway, y'all, we have a super guest here today, too. We're
going to
talk about that. In fact, he's been in a couple Super Bowls.
Yes, and he's a foodie.
And he's a foodie, too, so he knows all about it. So anyway, y'all, we're going to be back in just a second or so. You don't want to miss what our guest has to say about Super Bowl.
He's the blind man in the bleachers to the local hometown fans. And he sits beneath the speakers way back in the stands, listening to the play-by-play, waiting for our name. Oh, how he wants to hear his son get in the game. But the boy's just not a hero. It's strictly second team, though he runs each night for touchdowns.
Greetings, I'm Jake Hebert.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM KRVS.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, now broadcasting in HD radio technology.
Come on. If you don't, I'm gone. Baby, I love you, but please don't make me choose. I got the football blues. Baby, I'm a football fan. gotta make my stand.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. And Michelle, we're talking about the Dome rocking tomorrow. Because tomorrow, y'all, is the big Super Bowl game in New Orleans. And, of course, the city is wild. In fact, I was there last night at the restaurant, you know, and I tell you what. Did you ever see those old movies like the Romans and all that when they moved that Trojan horse up to the door and they brought those battering rams to the door and they started trying to beat the door?
Is that what happened?
That's what happened at the bar last night.
It's getting wild down there.
On the Bienville Street side, they had the Trojan horse trying to get in. But I tell you what. Anyway, y'all, it's crazy times in New Orleans, and, of course, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about Super Bowl, and, of course, we have one of my best friends, like a brother. You know, he's like a brother to me.
That's right.
Love him to death. And he knows more about this topic than anybody I know. I won't even talk to anybody else about it.
Well, we had to bring in the big guns because you and I are not experts on this topic.
Well, I mean, you know. You forget.
I know. 10-yard false.
She forgets I was 10-yard false. In those days when I played football, you went both ways, and that meant something different than today, you know. We went both ways. We played the whole game.
I know that you have a lot of football accolades.
Yeah, right.
And certainly, no disrespect.
Yeah.
I mean, you're in your own hall of honor.
They retired my jersey after the second game and put another number on me. They moved me from back to line. Huh?
They True retired story. My
jersey. Anyway, we have, like you said, one of your very best friends, Bob Baumhauer, with us on the show today. University of Alabama star, Miami Dolphins defensive pro. He began his football career at the University of Alabama, where he was a two-time All-American under none other than Coach Bear Bryant. He was drafted in 77 by the Miami Dolphins, and there began, additionally, an illustrious career playing in two Super Bowls and two Pro Bowls. You may even remember that Bob was one of the infamous Killer Bees, that defensive line which earned the Dolphins the ranking of first in the NFL in total defense in 1982. In 95, he was inducted into the Alabama Sports Hall of Fame. In 2008, the Miami Dolphins Ring of Honor. He was inducted into that as well. Unfortunately, in 86, he suffered some injuries that ended his football career. But Bob was a planner, and he already had his eye on what he wanted to do next. He opened and is the owner of Baumhauer Restaurants, a chain of restaurants throughout Alabama, where he serves the best wings around, among numerous other delicacies.
The wings are good. I mean, you get the best wings at Bob's, but I mean the best fish. He's all over the place. He's in my dining room now. I hate to say it. I'm in Louisiana. I ate the best oysters I ever ate in his place in Orange Beach.
Now, that's saying something.
Look, I'm telling you, the best oysters I ever ate in Orange Beach at his place over there at Dwarf. Okay.
Well, his love of the hospitality industry is certainly evident in everything that he does, the success of his restaurants, and he'll be the first to tell you, you know, and I love this, find what you love to do and be the best you can be at it. I love that. Bob, welcome to Stirring It Up. We're so excited to have you with us today.
Hey, thanks, y'all. I love that intro. Appreciate it. especially coming from my hero. And Michelle, I've talked to you about this before.
I'm glad I'm your hero, Bob. Is that what you were going to say?
Yeah, I'm your hero. You're right. Yes, ma'am. You got it, girl. Yeah, because you're the one that tries to keep him straight.
Try is the word.
It's a joy to be with you all. John, I just saw one of my really good buddies who has become a very good buddy of yours by helping you stir it up for the Louisiana Gumbo Bowl way back when, tornado relief we did in Tuscaloosa. I just saw AJ.
AJ Duhay, y'all, a good Louisiana boy. And Bob, you are not only good friends, but didn't y'all room together for many years?
We roomed together. We were in each other's weddings. you know, I know his family. Knew his mom and dad in reserve, and his brothers and sisters got to know him really, really well. But he was a lot of fun at that Louisiana Gumbo. He was stirring it up more than anybody.
Now, what Bob's talking about is Bob and I joined forces, and, of course, Michelle was there, too. Every time we looked for her to stir the pot, she was gone somewhere playing around. But Bob and I joined forces, and it was Bob's idea to bring our big kettle, our 4,000-pound kettle to Alabama when LSU played Alabama a couple years back, and we stirred up that 2 tons of seafood gumbo for charity. And Bob, not only was AJ was a celebrity star, but he ended up controlling the pot all day long. That was a lot of fun, wasn't it?
Well, it was the best. And that's AJ. You know, he's going to get involved. He's going to get down and dirty. And he started kind of directing traffic a little bit.
Hey,
watch out for that. Watch out for that.
Now, Bob, we should probably mention, because, you know, we have this hot Facebook page that Aslam, our engineer, keeps going over there. We should probably mention to everybody that in a couple months we're going to be doing another big gumbo cook-off down at Orange Beach, right? We should probably tell a little bit about that coming up, you know.
Yeah, that gumbo festival that is coming up this April in Orange Beach, Alabama. It's going to be called the L.A. You know, we can debate on, is that Louisiana or is that Lower Alabama? The L.A. Gumbo Festival, and there's going to be a cook-off, and it's going to be a ton of fun. It's there at the Wharf in Orange Beach, and there'll be some really good eating, obviously, and arts and crafts, music, just a lot of stuff for the family. Should be a really good time. I think it's the weekend of April 12th, right, Michelle?
That's right.
Yeah, April 12th. So everybody, right, mark your calendars. Anyway, Bob, I want you to know I'm oiling the big kettle, getting the air put back in the tire, so I'm getting ready. You ought to see this thing. It gets a lot of attention.
Wait.
And, Bob, I should mention, this is the first Baumhauer Falls production.
The first one didn't count?
No, baby. That was a scrimmage.
That was a scrimmage.
Come on, Michelle. This is Baumhauer Falls Productions right here with this big gumbo fest down there. L.A., of course, is Louisiana. Good news, it's a charity event. So anyway, we're going to put some stuff up on our website. I know Bob's going to do the same thing. So, Bob, how you been?
I'm great, man. I'm having a good time and can't wait for the Super Bowl in Louisiana. I had the opportunity to play in a couple Super Bowls, but one of the best times I ever had was playing in the Sugar Bowl. And it actually was the first Sugar Bowl in the Superdome back in the 70s. And nobody puts on the dog. Nobody does it better than New Orleans when it comes to whether it's a bowl game or whether it's the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl's in New Orleans, you know it's going to be a great time.
Well, Bob, we were talking about that earlier. I mean, tomorrow's the big game at the Dome, the big Super Bowl at the Dome. We were talking about why is New Orleans such a sought-after city for big events like that. And I said, of course, you know, it's the hospitality of the city. And naturally, it's the food. Naturally, it's the weather. Naturally, it's events like Bourbon Street, even family events like the zoos and the river and everything else. What do you think makes New Orleans such a great city for a Super Bowl?
I agree 100%. I think it starts with the people. I always just have such a fantastic time there, the hospitality, and then the folks of New Orleans and Louisiana, they just are so warm and so welcoming, and it seems like they really want to put on a good show for you. They want you to have a good time. And there's nobody better than that. There's just nothing like walking down Bourbon Street, watching everybody have a super time. And then you add, like what you're talking about, the history, the French Quarter just gives you a feeling. It's just something that happens to you when you walk into the French Quarter, especially if you're not from there. I can remember like it was yesterday, the first time walking into the French Quarter. It's one of those things that you never forget. And then you got, you know, the Mississippi River, the river boats, the music, you know, the jazz, everything. It just absolutely makes it the best atmosphere ever for big events.
And I think the diversity of the city, too, because a lot of times we think about Bourbon Street and the Quarter, which is so just historic and unbelievable, as you say, for a first-time viewer. But it's such a family-oriented city, too. There's so much going on that people can feel good about that. The hotels are great there. Anyway, we're looking for a great game tomorrow. So, Bob, you know, you were a pretty big guy playing football in high school.
He was.
This
good
is
God
a, this,
almighty.
Look,
I feel
high
like
school. He's in high school in Alabama, 6'5", mm-hmm, 230 pounds. You see, him and I got a lot of things going together. I'm 230 pounds, too. Just that I'm a foot and a half short.
Instead of being 6'5", you're 5'6".
I'm 5'6", but we weigh the same, so that must have something good to say about. Anyway, you weren't scouted by the University of Alabama at first, so tell us the story about how you became a member of that Crimson Tide.
Well, I tell you, I started playing ball late. I played at Tuscaloosa High School, just learning what I was doing. I didn't know what I was doing at the beginning of the year. I had moved to Alabama and was at Tuscaloosa 1 year. Had a decent year, got better through the year, but like you said, did not get recruited by Alabama or anybody else for that matter. And after the signing date had come and gone, for whatever reason, Vanderbilt up in Nashville gave me a call, asked me to come visit. I go up there, I visit, I have a great time. I call home, tell mom and dad, hey, they've offered me a scholarship up here. I'm going to go to Vanderbilt, SEC school, good school. And mom said, don't do anything. And the coach was sitting right across the desk from me when I called home. Don't do anything. The coaches from Alabama just called. They want to talk to you.
Oh, wow.
So I hung up the phone. I looked at the coach. His name was Charlie Bradshaw, John. He played for Coach Bryant at Kentucky. And so he was a Bryant guy, and he was the defensive line coach at Vanderbilt. I looked at him. I said, Coach, I just heard from my mom. Alabama wants to talk to me. I can't sign right now. I got to go hear what they got to say. He stood up, looked me in the eye, shook my hand. He said, good luck, buddy, because I ain't going to see you again. I know where you're going. I never forgot that. So classy. So I flew home from Vanderbilt, from Nashville. And back in the day, remember Southern Airlines, John? They had those little twin-engine 40-seat prop jobs back in the day. They flew directly into Tuscaloosa. Got into Tuscaloosa. There were seven coaches waiting for me. Now, they hadn't talked to me all year. This is 2 months after the signing date. It's like March, y'all. So they say, Bob, and mom and dad weren't there. I was expecting them to pick me up. They said, Coach Bryant would love to talk to you now if you'd go with us to go talk to him. And I'm like, what in the world is going on here? And so, you know, I said, sure. And we all loaded up in this big van, station wagon deal, took me over directly to Coach Bryant. Coach Bryant showed me in, was very nice, said, I don't blame you if you don't come here. We haven't shown you any respect, haven't given you any kind of attention, but I want you to play for me. I had no idea where that came from. I got chills right now thinking about it. Never, ever forgot that moment. But what happened, we talk about preparation, doing your homework and all those type of stuff, John, as far as, you know, what we do. Coach Bryant was reviewing all of the folks that they had signed, all the scholarships they'd given. He was watching film on everybody they signed that year, and he was watching film on their top offensive line prospect, and he was watching him get whooped. And it was me whooping him. Coach Bryant says, okay, we signed this big offensive lineman here. Where's the guy whooping him? And they told him, and they thought I might walk on. And the word was, Coach Bryant got really upset, and they said, if that kid signs with Vanderbilt, there's going to be some issues. I swear, and the coaches were acting nervous when I flew into Tuscaloosa. So long story short, it was Coach Bryant who was reviewing film, saw me on film against somebody they had already signed and said, we need that kid. It was the best thing that ever happened to me as far as football is concerned. And, you know, the guy changed my life. It's just one of those things that I feel like it was a gift, and I still feel that way. It was just an opportunity that I'm still thankful for and have never forgotten.
What an opportunity to just be in a place at a time when he is one of the top coaches in the world with a reputation that Coach Bryant not right. only had then, but only that reputation grew, to be at that perfect moment watching you whip up the guy that he had just signed.
Yeah.
If you had to choose one lesson in life that you learned from Coach Bryant, just one that you carry with you, what is it?
Well, when I went to Alabama, like I said, I was not into football, and I really didn't have a mission for myself. I didn't have any kind of direction. I wasn't playing football to be the best that I could be. I just was playing for all the wrong reasons. I got talked into it, and then I had some size and some quickness, got a scholarship. What Coach Bryant taught me, and he taught this to everybody that played for him, if they listened, John, was that we're all special. And that we have to look at ourselves that way, and that we just got to figure out what it is we want to do and do everything you can to be the best that you can be every day. You're going to fall down. You're going to get knocked down. Things aren't always going to go your way. But you need to feel like you can go somewhere, that you can do something special, and you need to have a vision for yourself. And if you feel that and you have that type of mentality where you're saying to yourself, okay, I can do this. I can do anything I want to if I want to bad enough. You can do special things. And when I first went to Alabama, I didn't think that way. By the beginning of my second year, I was buying into that, hey, I can do something with this. I can be a pretty damn good football player. I can be special. And on top of that, he always taught you, don't forget where you came from, be humble, take care of mom and dad. All the things that folks that get it don't forget.
Right.
And Coach Bryant never forgot where he came from, never did. It was always there for us, always was one phone call away. And he made you feel like you were special.
Well, I think it's the hallmark of all successful people is just one day realizing that it's in your heart and it's in your soul and it's in your attitude. You just have to go out, forget all of the adversity and forget where you came from and forget all of that kind of stuff. Just go out and remember that it's up to you, you know, and I think that's what his message was. Yeah.
And I'm not just shooting you a line of bull. I mean, I see that in you, John. And, you know, that trip to Restaurant Revolution, and I'm talking to my guys about it every day. I mean, you see that mentality, you see that attitude, you see John Foles in Restaurant Revolution, and that's what it's all about. You start thinking that way, and things like Restaurant Revolution happens, and Coach Bryant is the man that was responsible for giving me that gift to think that way.
And Bob, certainly you do be the best you can be always. How did the attitude from Alabama carry to your career with the Dolphins? I mean, it must have been a pretty easy transition with that.
It was. I was the luckiest guy on the planet to go from Coach Bryant to Coach Shula, who is still the only undefeated pro coach of all time. And Shula was the same way. I mean, you know, now it was more of a business-like approach, but Coach Shula was about doing things the right way for the right reasons. And when we prepared, when we came to camp every single year, it was not to have a winning season. It was not to get to the playoffs. It was to win a Super Bowl. Every year we took that approach. Every single year. We didn't always get there. But in my years at Miami, we got there twice. You know, just before I got to Miami, they had got there three times in a row and gone undefeated. And so playing for a guy like Coach Bryant absolutely set me up for success, laid the foundation for me to be able to create a relationship with Coach Shula that I love. You know, it was just amazing to be able to be in that organization. And I can remember so many times, John, you've probably been here, where I'd be driving down to practice and I'd just be thinking to myself, I don't deserve this. This is just too good.
No.
So I was just really fortunate to be able to be exposed to two guys with those type of leadership skills.
Well, Bob, look, I know our listeners out there just on the edge of their seat to continue to hear your philosophy and all that. We're going to take a quick break. Can you stay with us over the break, and we'll pick up the conversation on the way on the other side here?
Yes, sir.
And, y'all, you really don't want to miss another word of this because the fun hadn't begun yet. We had a big game is tomorrow, y'all. It's going to be hot as can be here in New Orleans. And you want to hear what Bob has to say about some of this stuff. We're going to be back in just a minute.
We were driving toward the goal line. They were screaming in the stands. I had the chance to be a hero, but it slipped right through my hands. There would have been a big pep rally. They would have hung my jersey on the wall.
Forget that these songs have been around for over 200 years. They're as popular as ever, sung in the fresh voices of today's singers. Discover the contemporary appeal of the songs of Robert Burns this week on The Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
Comics avec Val. Bienvenue dans le monde francophone. C'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie.
Hi, everyone. This is Pat Mitchell-Whirley, and coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we've got Girls with Guitars on the 2011 Legendary Rhythm and Blues Cruise. Then we'll head to the 2011 Blues Music Awards and hear from Cena Earhart. That, plus our feature host series, Heavenly Sight, A Gift Out of Blindness, continues. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
T'as des misères à réveiller le dimanche matin? Mais allume la radio avec moi, Louis Michaud, tous les dimanches matins, 7h jusqu'à 9h. On va charrer en français, écouter la musique en français et boire une petite tasse de café. Join me, Louis Michaud, if you have trouble waking up in the Sunday mornings. Just turn your radio to KRVS from 7 to 9 and hear me with Le Réveil, The Awakening en français.
When I feel that chill, smell that fresh cut grass, I'm back in my helmet, cleats and shoulder pads. Standing in the huddle, listening to the call. Fans going crazy.
Welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. Slama, that's some great football music you have there. Where'd you pick all of that up at? That's really good.
Yeah, that's pretty, ain't it?
You know, Slama, that's why you make the big money, you know? Michelle, I ask me every day, why do you pay Slama so much?
Oh,
and I'm sitting here dragging a weak paycheck home. I said, Slama's the man, Michelle. Anyway, y'all, welcome back. It's so nice to have all of you here at the kitchen table with us today. And, of course, we're talking to one of our absolute best friends, 1995 inductee into the Alabama Sports Hall of Fame. And then in 2008, Michelle, you mentioned it, the Miami Dolphins Ring of Honor. You know what I mean? But he's got the John Falls Ring of Honor, too. I mean, this guy's phenomenal. He inspires me.
I believe it. He's awesome.
He does. He does inspire me. But, Bob, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Loving it, man. I'm loving it.
Hey, Bob, we're talking about what a great guy you are, and I know that I think it was the 84 season, you were named to the third Pro Bowl, but you injured your knee, but you kept playing so that Miami would win the title. So you basically, you sacrificed yourself in that game because you ended up having to opt out of the Pro Bowl. That had to be a pretty difficult decision to make, and I'm sure you must make decisions like that still today.
Let me tell you, and that goes back to what you were talking about earlier. You got to love what you do. You know, you hear all this stuff about football, whether it's college or NFL, a lot of times it doesn't come off the way I would like to hear it come off sometimes. I think the vast majority of the guys playing the game play the game because they love it. And some of this stuff that you hear, vast majority of us, 99% of us, absolutely love the game and feel privileged to be able to play it and just want to be in there. You want to be a part of it. And I got to tell you, starting with my second year, there was always something going on. I played nose guard. I was hurt one way or another. That particular year, my knee, it was bothering me pretty bad. It affected my play, but it wasn't to the point where I felt like I couldn't be productive. Now, whether I was or not, I don't know. I did. The Pro Bowl is a funny animal. Sometimes you should be there early in your career, and you're not because you're not well known. And then you're late in your career, you're in the Pro Bowl. I ended up being in it five times. The last time or so, I probably didn't deserve to be in it because I didn't play as well as I thought I should have. That particular year, I don't know if I deserved to be in a Pro Bowl or not. But we were going towards the Super Bowl, and we had Marino, who was just knocking it out of the park and moving forward, and that's an opportunity that you don't always get. So you want to be a part of something, and you got to play hurt, man. And like you said, even in today's world, even in the restaurant business, there's a lot of folks in the restaurant business that play hurt, you know. But you know what I mean, John?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
You got to play hurt, baby.
Bob, one thing before we get off of that playing hurt, and then back even then, even though that wasn't a lifetime ago, it may seem a lifetime ago, I'm sure even the medical view or the treatment that players get today, the rehab, everything else that they have today is so different from what you had an opportunity to have in your career, right?
Oh, yeah, huge. You guys, I got to do a little, I got to brag on my nephew. He's Evan Mathis. He was, a lot of folks say he's the best guard in the NFL this year.
Wow.
Evan Mathis, you guys watch for him. but he's right in the middle of it now, and he talks to me all the time about the techniques that they use. And he's hurt a good bit, but he hasn't missed a game this year. He talks about all the time about the amazing things that they're able to do because of the improvements in treatment and rehab and all the above. So, and back then it was, hey, put a little ice on it, you'll be okay. You know, get that swelling down a little bit, you'll be okay. Things have changed a good bit that way.
One last question about football, and we'll jump on to the rest of your life. But what was that decision? When did that day come that you said, you know, I've given my life to the game, it's been unbelievable to me, but now I know it's done. I mean, I know I cannot contribute the way I know I need to contribute. What was that like? What was that day like, and when was it?
It was tough. It was very tough. And it started, you know, when I started having those serious knee issues in the mid-80s. And I came back. I wasn't the player I used to be. And then my contract was up, and the Dolphins still wanted me to come back. They wanted to sign me to another contract. I'd played for 10 years. And we were going round and round in negotiations, and I started thinking, am I going to be the guy that I was before, and am I going to be able to do the things that I had done that made me enjoy the game so much? And, you know, I was a nose guard my whole career, was usually getting doubled and triple teamed, and it usually took a couple guys to handle me. That wasn't the case anymore, and I didn't know if I could get back to that level. And, John, I had gotten into the restaurant business early on. I opened a little wing joint up in Tuscaloosa in 81. This was in the late 80s, and wings were starting to take off. And I said, you know what? I can't be who I was as a ball player. And if I can't be the best out there, I don't want to. The money was there. But if I can't be the best that I can be and be somebody that folks would look up to as a ball player, I need to step down. And that was in 88 when I decided to do that. We negotiated, and I was around in 87. There was a strike that year, but I decided in 88 I wasn't going to try to come back. That's one of the things that is really tough for ball players to deal with. I had issues with it. I had panic attacks, had anxiety attacks, did a lot of reading up on that type of stuff. Earl Campbell suffered from that. A lot of guys that leave the game, that loved it so much, has a problem with transition. Anyway, I can remember it very well. It's a good question, because it's a decision that we've all got to make at one point or another, and it doesn't always go the way you'd like it to as far as a script.
Right, I mean, I can feel it. I was just thinking as you were talking, 1988, you were trying to make a decision whether to go on with your career, and I had just made a decision to open the first restaurant on Soviet soil, 1988. In May, I signed a contract to open the first foreign restaurant in the Soviet Union. Scared as scared could be, I was one of the kids who had jumped under my desk to practice Americanism versus communism, and I was thinking to myself, am I crazy or what? I'm going to march into the Soviet Union to open the first foreign restaurant on Soviet soil, and I'm an imposter. I don't know anything about what I'm doing to do this. But you know what? I mean, I had the faith to do it, and I was thinking as you were talking about the emotion that goes through your mind, whether you're playing football or whether you're on your game is about jumping on a plane to go do something that's never been done before. And yep. I think the emotion's all the same. You know, you just have to convince yourself that now's the time, whether it's to do it or not do it, you know.
And John, you're not going to believe this, John. I got chills with you telling me that. Steve, Chef Zucker, was telling me that story yesterday. And he told me the same thing. You've probably shared that with him before, but we were talking about that yesterday and the sacrifices you had to make that happen. And he went into detail with me. It's funny you would bring that up. We were talking about that just yesterday. He said it was a huge move for you.
Well, it was a pivotal moment just like yours. I mean, it was a pivotal moment right in my life when I had to decide, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get on a plane, Aeroflot, which nobody had flown on. I'm going to go to Russia, and I'm going to do something. And it's like you. I mean, I see so many similarities in making decisions that are just so emotional that you have to make them. And then you do it, and you say, wow, how did I do that? Mm-hmm. Is what you think about later. I mean, I don't know if I could do that today. But anyway,
I'm with you. I think the same exact way.
But Bob, you are now an unbelievably successful restaurateur, and you're using the same management style that Bear Bryant did. I mean, motivating your people every day, and some making and some don't. Let's talk about your start. You just mentioned your little wings restaurant in Tuscaloosa. I know you were involved with Joe Namath early on. Tell us a little bit about that beginning.
You know, early on, in the late 70s, I had an agent. His name was Jimmy Walsh. He was also Richard Todd's agent, Doug Williams, a couple other guys. He had just a couple guys, and Jimmy went to Alabama, was buddies with Joe, and was Joe's agent. And Joe lived in South Florida, Fort Lauderdale. Richard and I, when I went to Miami, got a condo together in Fort Lauderdale, and Joe retired. And Jimmy is the one who came up with it. Our agent said, hey, let's do one more Bachelor Street. Joe had gotten into the business early on, you guys. He had a hamburger joint, a chain of restaurants up in the Northeast called Broadway Joe's, and he had several of these Bachelor Street. I think they had all closed. They come up with the idea, let's do another one. So Richard, Joe, and I were the three bachelors in Fort Lauderdale, opened in 79. And that was one of those things where it was nobody's priority. We really didn't pay enough attention to the guest and the preparation that it takes to be able to meet the guest's expectations. It didn't last long. A bunch of great people, but we didn't know what we were doing. I'll never forget it. I was asked to go to lunch one day by one of my teammates, and I said, where are we going? He says, wings and things. And I said, well, they serve there. He goes, chicken wings. And this was before I knew what buffalo wings were. I said, you want me to go somewhere and eat chicken wings for lunch? He was from Kansas. And I said, is this a Kansas thing? His name was Steve Toll, linebacker for the Dolphins. And we went to a little place called Wings and Things that was owned by Eddie Hauk. Eddie had become a Dolphin fan. We became great buddies. He helped me open a little place on campus in 1981. Eddie is now involved down here in South Florida with Bob Brzezinski. They have several restaurants in South Florida now called Brews Room. But that's how I got into business. And then when I retired in the late 80s, like we were talking about earlier, that's when I made a call that I'm going to get into this hospitality business and see what I can do. And I've just been trying to learn the business ever since.
How many restaurants do you have total now?
We have 13 now. We're having fun. It is still a very real learning experience. As you well know, John.
No, it is. We never really know because the customer measures us daily with their choices and with their feet and with their pocketbook. They come in and tell us whether we're doing a good job or not. We don't need the market study. All we need to do is look at the tables in our restaurant. If they're full, we're meeting their needs. If not, we need to go back and check out the game plan, you know, and that's exactly. I can tell you right now, I mean, you've just started some new restaurants up in Orange Beach. Tell us a little bit about those.
I appreciate you bringing that up. You know, we got involved down in Orange Beach, Alabama years ago and had a restaurant called Mango's, a restaurant called Calypso Joe's. Ivan and Katrina combined to chase me out of Orange Beach. And But we have since then come back and opened a couple restaurants at a gorgeous, gorgeous facility. It's called The Wharf on the Intercoastal Waterway, beautiful marina, 10,000-seat amphitheater, all kinds of great shopping and some other good restaurants as well. But we've opened a Complete Angler Seafood Bar and Grill, which is named after the book The Complete Angler, and a place that was made famous by Hemingway.
Beautiful restaurant, beautiful, beautiful.
We love it. We love it. And then we did a, it's a little different than all my other Baumhauers. It's a sports-themed restaurant in a beautiful space there. It's waterfront, all kinds of alfresco dining out there on the water. Really, really good stuff. And we love it. And I tell you what, y'all, we have a ton of Louisiana folks that come over to Orange Beach, and we absolutely love having them over there. They're so much fun, and they seem to enjoy our beaches over there a good bit.
Well, Bob, in closing, I want to say that I've heard you say often, if you're going to be special at something, you really need to love it. You love what you do. I love what I do. And I've always known in the back of my heart that one day, I don't know when, you and I are going to do something together. I just know
well,
we got it.
We got to do it.
And we're going to kick it off with that big L.A. gumbo cook-off in April. So we're going to let everybody know all about it. Bob, you're a great friend. You're a great humanitarian. We love you to death. And I never have enough time to talk to you, and I appreciate that so much.
I appreciate that, buddy. You know I feel the same way.
And hug Leslie and the kids for us. We appreciate it so much, okay? Bob, love you.
I'll see him in a little bit.
Love you and see you soon. Bye-bye. He's a great guy.
Oh, I love Bob Baumhauer. Gentle giant.
So, Slama, bring us up to date. What's going on our Facebook page? That's facebook.com/stirringitupradio. We want people to constantly be contacted. What's happening on that?
Yeah, so on Facebook, Stirring It Up right now, we're letting people come in and show us what they're cooking. You know, we had the Merlitons a while back, and that was from Hubble. We're waiting for you guys to come on and post on that Facebook.
And this is a great opportunity because we were asking our stove hounds to submit a picture and a recipe and tell us a little story about that famous dish that they like to do, handed down for generations in their family. And we're going to choose one of them to be a guest on the show every month and have them come sit down in the studio with us and talk to our guests so that they could ask Bob a couple questions.
Yeah.
We know the stove hounds out there all cooking. We know they're all doing great things. So they can send us pictures of their Super Bowl dish tomorrow. You know, they can send us that if they want to. I'm going to be doing my Super Bowl sliders with that Spanish pork roast, which I'm going to tell you about. Anyway, what about our big cochon de lait?
The first annual boucherie dinner at Restaurant Revolution.
Yeah.
Everything is set for Sunday, February 24th. We're going to start about 6 o'clock with a charcuterie reception.
That's about 20 days from now.
Yeah.
And that's at Revolution, and we're going to start with a little boudin, hogshead cheese, and all kind of nice things that we're making out of pork. And then you're going to sit down to about, like you say, about a 5-6-course meal that's going to go all the way through everything from soup to desserts. And, of course, you can go to our website, jfalls.com, and I think right in the front of our website page, jfalls.com, I think they can go and find all of the information, including pictures of the pigs, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, it is limited seating.
50 people, that's it.
50 people is it. It's $250 a person. And you call Revolution. We've got the number on the screen there to make your reservation.
Yeah. Anyway, y'all, I did put my recipe on the website, jfalls.com. Just make sure you go right there, too, and you're going to find my wonderful recipe for my Super Bowl pork sliders, adobo pork sliders. That's what I'm doing tomorrow. And I want to thank Bob in a big, big way, you know, for being here with us, Michelle.
Oh, he's a great guy.
He's a great guy.
Awesome to have him with us.
So y'all be careful out there and drink responsibly and just make sure you cheer for your team. I'll certainly be cheering for mine.